Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about foot and mouth disease. For more than a month now, Britain has been struggling with an outbreak of this disease. It is extremely infectious and has spread very quickly from just one swine operation to over 750 farms and upwards of 764,000 animals, and that has happened in less than 6 weeks. It has been extremely expensive and will continue to be. A spokesman for the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has said so far the direct cost of dealing with the foot-and-mouth outbreak has been £600 million, that's $859 million, and it has been estimated that eventually the cost could be over $4 billion. Foot and mouth has also spread to Europe. Netherlands has 15 confirmed cases, France 2, and Ireland 1. The disease has not been seen in the United States since 1929, but there seems to be growing concern here in this country that there is a possibility that foot and mouth might be spread by some means from Europe to this country. And so officials of the Agriculture Department thinks people who are concerned with making sure that diseases, plant and animal diseases, don't come from other countries to this country have increased their level of vigilance. And yet, as I say, some people clearly are worried about the possibility of foot and mouth coming back to the United States. We thought this morning on the program we would talk a little bit about just what foot and mouth disease is, what causes it, how it spread, and some of the measures that have been taken to try to make sure that it doesn't gain foothold again here in this country, and also talk about some of the economic aspects of this outbreak. We have two guests joining us this morning. They're both from Purdue University, one to talk with us about the disease angle and one about the economic angle. Our guests are Marshall Martin. He is associate head of the Department of Agricultural Economics. He's also director of the Center for Agricultural Policy and Technology Assessment. Our other guest is H. Leon Thacker. He is professor of veterinary pathology. He's also director of the Animal Disease Diagnostic Lab. And they're joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk with our two guests, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Also, though, we do have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, we'll pay for the call, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, Professor Thacker, hello.
Good morning.
And Professor Martin.
Good morning.
Thanks to both of you for talking with us. First, I think I'd like to ask some very basic questions and probably direct them to Professor Thacker. Although, as we go along, by the way, if one of the other of you wants to comment on something, please feel free to go ahead and pass it back and forth. But first, in Britain, they tend to call this foot and mouth. And I know that some people in this country would rather refer to it as hoof and mouth because that tells you a little bit more about the animals that are affected, more specifically cloven-hoofed animals. So let's start with this question, Professor Thacker. What animals are susceptible?
Just to give you the name of some of the species, swine, of course, as you mentioned in your introduction, that's how it entered into England. Swine are high on the list of susceptibility. Sheep, cattle in this country, deer, elk, and among the wild species that could be a factor in spreading it should it get to this country. It's also a disease that affects elephants. There has been a recent report that this has gotten into a large sanctuary of elephants in India, and that's very unfortunate. It also affects camelids, which would include camels, alpacas, llamas, but the camelid species are less susceptible than some of the others. Now, there are also species that can become infected with this and carry it, but not, for the most part, develop the disease, and that would include hedgehogs, which are small, kind of warm, fuzzy animals from England. That's been one of the reasons people can't bring hedgehogs out of England over the years, because they can carry this disease. It's also been carried by rats. So it affects a wide variety of species, but fortunately, people are not one of those.
One point where I've been a little confused in what I have looked at concerns horses. Can horses get hoof and mouth?
Horses could physically carry it, just like it could be carried on used farm machinery, which is one of the things that was of concern a few weeks ago in the U.S., but they do not become affected with the disease.
So it's just it's the issue there with horses is that not that they could get it, but that they could they could be an agent of transmission.
That's right.
Let me ask a question that I had from a reporter yesterday, Leon, that I could not answer. The question was, if a person was traveling in Europe, consumed a meat product that might have been infected with the virus, and then came to the back of the U.S., could that be carried through the body of the person if they consumed the food?
Not likely, mainly because the virus is quite susceptible to low pH. And obviously when it went through a monogastric animal stomach, it's going to be subjected to quite low pH. And so that would likely inactivate it. But we couldn't say for sure that if it were to pass through the digestive tract of a person or another animal, particularly a horse, and not be subjected to pH low enough to inactivate the virus, then it potentially could be infected.
And you mentioned, Professor Thacker, just a moment ago, just to make sure that that people heard this and if there was any sort of concern, that human beings cannot get hoof and mouth. It's my understanding, though, that apparently in Britain, this has further contributed to the decline in meat consumption. Of course, for now some time, people there have been concerned about BSE, about what so-called mad cow disease. But apparently this is just further leading people away from eating meat. And maybe again here we ought to underscore the fact that as far as I have seen, even if an individual ate meat from an animal that was infected, this is not going to cause any particular problem for the person.
That's correct. It's not considered to be a zoonotic disease, and I think you're exactly right that part of the confusion here and probably part of the reason of influencing people's eating habits is the fact that foot and mouth disease and our, quote, mad cow disease, which is a bad name to have put on it, I'm afraid, but it's quite descriptive. But anyway, I think a number of the public have confused these because they both come from England for the most part rather recently, even though it appears as though BSE or bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which I would prefer to refer to mad cow as BSE, BSE, it appears, arose in England. Now, foot and mouth disease has been a disease that we've known for many, many, many years, and it's doubtful that it arose in England. It's just that it had an outbreak there, as you said earlier, I think about 6 weeks ago.
I think it's important to keep in mind that we've had outbreaks of hoof and mouth disease, or in Latin America, in Spanish, it's called aftosa, has been in Argentina and other South American countries off and on for a number of years. It's also been prevalent in parts of Africa and Asia. So this has been a problem in a number of countries around the world periodically for a long time.
Yeah, and apparently, again, according to what I read, the only continents on the planet where you don't see it are North America, Australia, and Antarctica. I have that right?
That's right. And it has been here. I mean, it was,
yes,
as you said,
yes,
earlier, it last seen in the U.S. in 1929. But it has been on the North American continent many years ago.
Well, the British, as we do, had in place a system to try to monitor and prevent the spread of foot and mouth. And obviously, in that case, for them, it was not successful. And we saw how quickly, over a period of weeks, this managed to spread. How do you think, or does anybody know, how this got started in Britain and how it took hold there?
Well, it's my understanding that in England, they did not have a law on their books that required food materials that would be coming, say, from a restaurant or whatever, that these be cooked before they could be fed to swine. Hmm. We've had that as a federal law many, many years in this country. I mean, if you're going to go get restaurant waste and feed it to pigs in this country, you can do that, but you cannot do it unless you cook that. In England, that law was not in effect. And so if someone came from one of these countries that Dr. Martin had mentioned, and it appears as though this is an Asiatic strain, I think it's a strain O that they're having problems with now. If someone came from a country where that was present in an animal population, and as a matter of fact, if they had taken sausage from a pig that had died with this disease, that flesh or that meat would have contained virus. That could have been discarded into restaurant waste and fed to a pig, and then when it got into that pig, then it takes off as a virus infection. Mm. Now, I've seen it estimated by some virologists in this country. It's been estimated that foot and mouth disease gets into this country every day. It's just that it doesn't get hooked up with a susceptible species to take off as a epidemic, so to speak, as they are experiencing in England.
It surprises me in a way to hear that there would be no restriction like that in Britain, given the kind of difficulties they've had over the past few years with these transmissible spongiform encephalopathies.
Right.
Why, and I suppose this would be a question for the Parliament, I guess, you know, during question time, they would stand up and say, why is it that we haven't done something about this? But it does indeed surprise me that's not something they've tried to address.
Right. I understand that it's in effect now.
But no.
It might be useful if we have a brief discussion about what are the symptoms of the disease and how it's expressed in the animal.
Sure. Well, I guess maybe, again, Professor Thacker, would you want to talk about that?
I can only give you what I've read. I've not seen this. Obviously, I wasn't quite a veterinarian in 1929. Not quite that old, but
but I have seen.
Oh well, all right.
I live in South America, so I've treated. Go ahead.
And
I'll comment.
Either of you, either or both, can comment.
Yeah,
my understanding is that in different species show this to different degrees, and this is. My understanding, and this partly has come from reports we've gotten back from veterinarians who are in England now, and in fact, we do have some veterinarians that have been called from England from our state veterinarian's office, and one from our Indiana area veterinarian in charge office have been assigned to go there to spend a month. But some of the feedback that they've given us and also some of the reading we've done suggests that sheep do not show the lesions as classically, or they don't show the lesions as severe as perhaps cattle or swine show this. By that I mean that classically we look for vesicles on the foot, and the reason we call it on the foot instead of the hoof is actually kind of like our fingernail, and so it doesn't ulcerate or get blisters. I mean, you can imagine if you look at your fingernail, you're not going to get blister on your fingernail, so you don't get blisters on the hoof. But you can get it on the foot, and so that's why it's called foot and mouth instead of hoof and mouth. Mm-hmm. And so these blisters form. There will be blisters on the mouth. It may be on the foot. They may have them in lactating animals. It may be on the teats, and that's just a predilection site for this virus. It shows a predilection to attack the epithelium in these various sites. Sheep do not show lesions as severely or well-developed blisters that we may see on the snout or the mouth of pigs or see it on the mouth of cattle. I've seen a number of these on cattle where it would undermine the essentially the lining of the tongue so that lining, when someone were to pull that tongue out of the cow's mouth, that it essentially would slide off in her hand. So.
I might add further that when I was working in Bolivia 35 years ago and was managing an operation, a school, a training program, and we had to get into our dairy operation and our cattle, and as he said, they were having trouble walking because of the lesions in the hoof. and the foot, and then also these blisters in the mouth. And so basically they were not able to go out on pasture comfortably to eat. They were not wanting to eat because of the pain in the mouth from the ulcerations. And so basically they just weren't eating, which is going to quickly affect their health status and their ability to produce milk. The locals there had old practices like treating the hooves with copper sulfate, and one of the local remedies was to use grapefruit to try to get some acid sort of treatment on the lesions in the mouth. That was the local home remedy that I ran into in Latin America 35 years ago.
Mm. And as you suggested, apparently this does not necessarily kill the animal outright, but the problem is that then if the animals aren't eating, they're not going to produce whatever it is that you want them to produce, milk or wool or meat, and that would mean even though the animal might not die, that essentially as far as the producer is concerned, the animal's worthless, and in addition to the fact that it can then spread the disease to other animals.
Exactly right.
That's right.
The mortality or the death loss from this, I've seen a number of different figures published, but in adult animals, 5% is about as high as I've ever seen, and I've seen it more often published as about 2%, so that there are other diseases that are much more deadly when animals get it as far as being a fatal infection. It will cause death in a higher percent than that in very young animals or very old animals. But in and of itself, many of these animals will recover, but it takes a long time, and it will definitely knock down their production of either meat or milk. It puts them in a very painful state for quite some period of time.
Yeah. Maybe I ought to just real quickly here introduce the two guests. If someone has just tuned in, we're speaking with H. Leon Thacker. He's professor of veterinary pathology, and Marshall Martin. He's an agricultural economist. He's also director of the Center for Agricultural Policy and Technology Assessment, both of them at Purdue University. And we're talking about foot and mouth disease. And if you have questions, they're certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to ask a question that goes to the issue of what we're doing to try to make sure that we don't have a problem with this in the United States. And again, I'm reminded of this because of Professor Thacker's comment about how you weren't around in 1929. The United States Animal Health Association, which is an independent group that's led by state vets, says they're kind of concerned about what would happen if there was an outbreak of the disease. Apparently, in a report that they put out in 1998, they suggested that the first cases might be misdiagnosed because producers haven't seen it before. Do you think that that's actually a problem, that it might go unnoticed because as there are not that many people around, or maybe there isn't anybody around who would have not very many people would have seen it before?
On the one hand, yes, there would be very few people. As Dr. Martin said, he had seen this. There would not be a very high percent, I don't think, of people involved with animal agriculture in this country who would have direct experience with it. But I think just like this program we're putting on right now, I mean, to heighten awareness of this amongst producers and veterinarians that this is a possibility, and to emphasize the importance that as soon as it can be diagnosed, if it does get to this country, the less the economic and animal agriculture impact that will be there through quarantine and isolation procedures that would be put in effect immediately.
One of the concerns that I have is we have a lot of people that are traveling normally to Europe, and they may not even be on a farm. They may be in rural areas or visiting zoos or other places where there might be animals or potential contamination with the virus. And so I certainly would hope that all of the listeners who are traveling or contemplating traveling to any of these countries, Europe or Argentina or elsewhere, that they follow all of the recommended procedures when they come back into the country, that their clothing has been washed, that they've showered, that they check the box, been on a farm, on the form they fill out to come through immigration, that they, you know, may need to disinfect their feet through a bath to come through, and they fully comply with all of these preventative measures that are part of our regulatory procedures, so we don't run a risk of bringing it back into the country inadvertently.
I fully agree with that, and if anything, I would say go beyond what those suggestions are, because I think some of the suggestions that I've read on this say that you should stay away from a farm for 5 days. Well, it's been shown that from the hair of someone who had been in contact with an infected animal, they can isolate this virus from the hair of an individual for 30 days afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so if you had the preference of staying off of a farm, I would be in favor of requesting that an individual not come in contact with those susceptible species for a period well beyond 5 days, if at all possible.
And I just know there are a number of people that may be students on our campuses who will be doing study abroad this summer, or other people as tourists traveling. We just be very careful, and that's one important thing. I think our other government officials are being very cautious about not importing animals or unprocessed meat or livestock products, but it's important for just the casual traveler tourist to fully comply, because I know it's sometimes easy to get cavalier and, you know, not check the right box, you know, be in a rush to go through customs and immigration, and we just don't want to bring this back in.
All right. Well, we have a caller, and we'd certainly welcome others if folks have questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our caller here is in Urbana, online one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You have been discussing my question, precautions for travelers. We've had a trip planned to England since January and didn't anticipate the problem over there, and we decided not to cancel.
Mm-hmm.
My specific question has to do with the fact that I have a horse. He's a single guy in a barn, backyard horse. I do all the stable care. Our family's going to be taking care of him for 3 weeks while we're away, and I know when we return, they will be happy for me to resume the barn chores. What is my problem? You say horses can be carriers but not show signs of the disease. My horse really doesn't go anywhere, so I assume taking the precautions you're describing would take care of it. Now, we're going to Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire. Every morning I look on The Guardian, and I can get a list of every farm in England that has sick animals. And I know we can't go rambling about, but we will be in the towns. But we will be there. So my concern is, do I need to stay away from my horse for a month?
No, not unless you were going to take your horse to somewhere that horse would be coming in contact with a member of a susceptible species. If
uh-huh.
your horse was going to be in contact with a pig or a calf or a sheep through exhibition or whatever means mm-hmm. that they might physically carry some of that virus, that would be a possibility.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, your horse is not going to be affected with this virus at all.
Yes.
You carry it back, but hopefully you're going to be cognizant and
surely
launder and dry clean your clothing when you return. I think that's a good idea.
Uh-huh.
And if you are in these places, I think it's good to use a disinfectant solution that's recommended of 5 tablespoons of household bleach per gallon of water.
5 to a gallon.
Yes.
Okay.
Use that to wash off any of the footwear that you may have that would be in contact with potentially infective soil or whatever while you're in England.
Mm-hmm. All right. I appreciate this, and it's reassuring, and we will follow all the instructions. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah,
thank you.
Have a good trip.
Just to I don't want to belabor this point too much, but I know that it does concern people, and particularly even people have heard about the fact that the virus that causes the disease can actually be spread on the wind. Maybe now you're not, if you're walking down the high streets of London, you're not going to come across it. But if you're in a rural area, Is it possible that you might encounter the virus, or do you really have to, in a fairly deliberate way, go to a farm, get close to the places where animals are raised?
The research was done on this was done back in 1970, and they had four individuals who were in the presence of swine heads. And the reason that was used is that swine is one of the species that sheds the virus in very, very high numbers, maybe higher than most any other. So they had four individuals who were in the presence of a slaughter facility, or actually probably a necropsy facility, where they had contact with the heads of these pigs that had the disease. That was much more exposure than you would expect to find outside in the open air from the virus. It was found that these individuals, for 28 hours after they were in presence of these pigs' heads, just breathing naturally, as you and I are here, in the presence of that virus, they could pick up enough of that virus on the mucosa of their respiratory epithelium that after that, 28 hours after that, one of these individuals, as it's described in the article that this is published, they sneezed and coughed and whatever other means of trying to give an aerosol to calves after having been in the presence of these pigs. As much as 28 hours after that, when they coughed in the face of a calf, one out of four of those calves picked up the virus.
So what you're saying is it's very contagious,
yeah,
and can be moved. So I think the answer to your question is that even if you're walking on the streets or out in more rural areas but not actually on a farm, that I think the same precautions we just talked about should be taken.
Hmm. Well, we have other callers. Let's go to Clark County. This is our next person's on our line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have not heard anything about foot and mouth disease in China. In July, I will be going to China for 2 weeks, and I will, it's an agriculture mission, so I'll be spending most of that time on farms. What kind of precautions are necessary there?
Go ahead, Dr. Thacker.
I'm sure that the disease is there. And so exactly what we're talking about coming back from England should be practiced in a return from China. And there are other diseases that are also present in China, and not the least of which is classical swine fever, or what we knew for years as hog cholera. So the precautions that we're talking about from England should be practiced, I'm sure, upon a return from China, particularly if you're going to be coming in contact with farm animals.
We will definitely be coming in contact with farm animals.
So again, my recommendation would be is follow all the procedures of washing your clothes and disinfecting your shoes and following all the precautions as you come back from that trip.
Okay.
And staying away from farm animals upon your return for at least 5 days. And as I said earlier, I'd recommend that it be a little longer than that if possible.
Well, I live on a farm, and although we are not producing livestock from a commercial standpoint, we have farm animals on our farm.
Uh-huh. If you could get someone else to do the chores during that period of time, it'd probably be a good safeguard.
Well, that might be another advantage of going on the trip.
That's right.
I was thinking the same thing.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Let's go to Windsor, another caller here, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I have a twofold question here. Number one, why is this disease specific to animals of a cloven hoof? And number two, could genetic modification be an alternative to eliminating this problem forever?
Dr. Thacker, go ahead.
It's not a good answer, but it's as good as I've got as to why it's in cloven hoofed animals and not others. God just made it that way, I guess. I don't have a better suggestion for that. It's just that these animals are susceptible, and birds, horses, a number of these species are just not susceptible. Now, as far as genetics, there probably is one of the reasons, as Dr. Martin said earlier, there are a number of places in the world where this disease is essentially enzootic, in that it occurs there in the animal population almost every year. One of those is Saudi Arabia and in some of the Mideast countries. They have this essentially every year. Now, one of the reasons it isn't expressed as severely there as it is, say, in England, is that you have a completely naive population in England. We have animals there that have not experienced this virus before, so they have no immunity to it. And so they're going to pick it up, and when they become infected, they're going to shed very high numbers of the virus. As far as genetically engineering animals that would be resistant to it, that would potentially be a possibility. One of the things I know that's being worked on with this is to develop a vaccine whereby we could tell the difference in a test between antibodies that are produced to the vaccine and antibodies that are produced by the natural virus. To my knowledge, that vaccine is not available at this point in time. Essentially, all the vaccine that is available or that is used around the world is killed vaccine, and that's one of the big reasons against using the vaccine is that it kills our exports for at least a year after that last vaccinated animal is killed in whatever country the vaccine is used in.
You might also add, I think, aren't there about 7 different strains?
Exactly.
So it's difficult to have the right vaccine.
Right. There are 7 major strains of the virus, and then there are several sub-strains to that. And one strain, if we have resistance to one strain of the virus, an animal that's resistant to one strain of the virus may be susceptible to any one of the others. So it does not cross-protect.
Mm. So that suggests there the difficult, some people might say, or they might have heard about the fact that there is a vaccine. They might say, well, why not just vaccinate all the animals?
Right.
The answer is, well, you can't just give one shot that will protect against all forms. And then there's this additional issue that once you have vaccinated the animal, then that animal is going to test positive for FMD. And if you want your animals to be certified, all of the animals from your country certified FMD free, well, you can't do that. Just as a matter of blanket policy, even if you had a vaccine you could give to all the animals, you probably wouldn't want to do it unless you felt like you really had to.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons that this decision of using the vaccine is such a matter of high concern right now, and one that is being looked at from all angles conceivable by people in England now.
So I would add that has significant economic consequences.
Right.
And that's why, in a kind of a cost-benefit sense, the decision has been made so far in places such as the United Kingdom to identify and destroy those animals to try to bring the disease under control rather than to go into a vaccination regime.
Yeah. We have talked a little bit perhaps about the economic angle of this, and maybe just for a moment we should do that. The figure that I'd seen, and I think I mentioned at the beginning of the program, is that somebody has estimated that by the time this is all over, the costs to the government of Britain could be over $4 billion. And not only is that a result of the difficulties that farmers face, but it also has to do with people who were going to go to Britain canceling their trip, so it's loss of money from tourism. Do you think, Professor Martin, that figure is accurate? Could it really be more than $4 billion, the cost of this for the British?
I don't know what the exact number is, but the studies I've seen suggest that, while yes, indeed, the farm level costs are significant and rising, that probably the bigger cost to the economy in the UK and maybe in some other European countries is the other non-farm but rural-related activities, tourism being the main one, and so to the extent that people cancel their trips or don't travel or walk or hike or bike in the countryside, that has an impact on restaurants and hotels and various tourist activities, and that cost could be much greater even than the cost of having to identify and destroy the animals. So it could be quite large.
Hmm. Has this had an impact on livestock prices around the world?
Yes. Hog prices have been up in part, I think, in this country because of some concerns about the disease outbreak in Europe.
Now, I suppose, you know, one wouldn't want to wish ill of producers elsewhere, but is this been, can one actually say for producers in this country, this has been good because it means the possibility that they can see a little bit higher price and maybe possibility of exporting some product that otherwise they wouldn't?
I think that's quite possible. And I mean, it's kind of a perverse sort of way to wish for somebody
yeah,
else. I
yeah.
understand your question, but I think that's true. I mean, to the extent that the Europeans may be limited in some exportation of meat products, then that may be some opportunity for us to export into markets where they otherwise would serve. And I do think that we've had two factors help increase hog prices in recent weeks in this country. Part that the Hogs and Pigs report that came out some weeks back suggests not quite as many animals as we initially thought there might be, as well as this international issue. So prices have improved some for our producers.
Well, we have a couple of other callers. Let's get back to the phones here to Urbana. That's the next person in line. On line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to ask in regards to the mass slaughter and quarantine policy that is being practiced in Europe, and I guess I heard of one instance in this country, in Vermont. Given that the disease does not seem to affect humans and doesn't even, for the most part, kill the livestock involved, and the guest mentioned that it did seem to be present in China and I think Saudi Arabia, and it's not being dealt with that way there. Why isn't the possibility even seem to be being discussed of just letting the disease play its course and I guess maybe developing some kind of more general immunity to it?
One of the things that keeps livestock prices up in our country are export markets. And if we were to adopt the fact that we're going to live with foot and mouth disease, it would shut down the majority of export markets that we have. And perhaps Dr. Martin would expand on that more. But the thing that makes this disease so devastating is not necessarily the number of animals that die from it, but by the fact that when it enters a population, the number of animals that become affected with it approaches 100%. It is so infective. I don't know of any human diseases that, I mean, we talk about the influenza outbreak that happened in this country back in the early 1900s. I guess that approached us, but as far as animal population goes, we know of no other virus that is as infective as this one. When it gets into a population, it just affects essentially every animal in the group. And that is what makes it so devastating and makes it so undesirable for a country to have it in their animal population.
And as we've said before, that when those animals become infected, they cannot eat properly. They're not growing properly. They're not producing the milk, and so it has significant economic impacts, both in terms of the cost to treat it as well as the loss of production or productivity. And so that can be a serious economic problem for not only the farmers but for the society.
And you think it's clear that, say, in Britain, if they hadn't done this mass slaughter and all these measures that caused the $4 billion of losses that you just mentioned, that the losses would have been greater by using vaccination along with letting the disease play out its course in some...
This is still being looked at by the government in England. It's not completely... Up to this time, obviously, they have elected to follow the policy of trying to stamp the disease out with elimination of affected animals. But I know from some of the conversation that we've seen going here that it's still being considered to initiate use of vaccination in England.
I might add, and Dr. Thacker, you may want to comment on this, that we've followed a similar policy in this country on other diseases. For example, hog cholera is a case where we no longer vaccinate. We've been able to eradicate it and not have to vaccinate. So hoof and mouth disease is not the only case where we followed a policy of trying to destroy infected animals and not vaccinate to control a disease. Is that not correct?
Right. There have been a number of diseases that we don't have in this country, and it was eliminated on the basis of elimination of animals affected with it. Bovine contagious pleuropneumonia, we are essentially free in this country of brucellosis. In Indiana, we're free from tuberculosis in animals. These are all diseases that can affect people that have been eliminated from our animal population by getting rid of the animals that are affected. Now, hog cholera is one that's been eliminated from the United States, and it is not a disease that is transmissible to people. Pseudorabies, right now, pseudorabies has been eliminated from Indiana swine within the last year. It took quite a number of years to do that, but the reason that this was done was not only that that swine herds that do not have pseudorabies are more profitable, but it also allows us to compete in an export situation as a state, because if we sat here essentially the only state in the U.S. or amongst a number of states as the only one that had pseudorabies, we wouldn't other states would not want to import our pigs.
So thank you. And so the point I want us to make is that this approach is one that's been used for diseases in animals other than just
right.
The hoof and mouth disease. And the calculations typically have been it's more cost-effective in the long run to try to eradicate the disease than let it run its course or to try to vaccinate for it.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Champaign for another caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. I have actually a question and then a comment coming up from the last caller's question. My question first, and I apologize if you've answered this already in any way because I didn't hear the entire hour. We have friends coming to visit soon from Holland, and I was wondering if they're going to be facing any particular unusual treatment at the airport, you know, like having to be fumigated or something like that, and coming from a country where there is an outbreak, even though not an enormous one, and in an area where they're, you know, it's a country where there are animals kind of throughout. It would be kind of hard to be sure that people hadn't been in contact. That's my first question. The other thing was just to comment that I gather that it's been a mandatory extermination of the infected animals in England, right? And I was just wondering why they haven't, picking up on the last caller's question, left it to the discretion of the owner to decide whether it's economically, that person judges it to be preferable for an economic grounds or other grounds to exterminate. It could perhaps just have a quarantine if the people chose not to. Anyway, those are things I wanted to ask about.
Dr. Thacker, let me take the second question, and then you might want to answer the first one. On the second one, this is what economists would call an externality sort of issue. As we've already discussed this morning, it spreads so quickly, so easily, that it can go from one farm to the next. So you cannot leave it up to an individual farmer to make the decision because the ramifications, the negative economic impacts, affect everyone in the community or in the country. So you can't let each farmer decide. You have to work together as a country or a region to bring it under control.
I see.
So that's why it has to be mandatory to make it work and be effective.
Right. I mean, I would understand that if they were all going to die from it, but as the last caller said, the fact that they can survive it. But I understand it's because of the expense of,
Well, they survive, but they continue to spread the disease.
Yeah.
So if one farmer said, well, I don't want mine killed.
Right.
And the animals are sick. It's kind of like, you know, letting your kids go to school when they're sick. It's better to keep them home and let them get better before you have everybody in the classroom with the flu.
But killing is a lot more extreme than, you know, letting them go to school.
Yeah, well, I understand, but
I see the point of it.
By animals that are not brought under control.
Yeah, okay.
Why don't you talk about the precautions again of coming into this country with her guests coming from the Netherlands.
And getting back to this spread, each one of these infected animals that we see is like a little virus factory.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can think of one of these sheep out in that, or a pig, if we see it on the TV, that is a foot and mouth disease affected individual. That's a little virus factory, and the only way we can get rid of the disease by stamping it out is to take away each one of those factories.
Mm-hmm.
Because as long as that animal is affected, and if you see cattle with ropey saliva coming out of their mouth, all of that saliva is very infective.
Mm-hmm.
The milk that's produced by one of these animals that's affected is infective. The meat that comes from one of these animals is infective. So the only way we can get rid of it is to get rid of those little virus factories, whether or not it's a little, I guess if it's a 1,000-pound cow, but to get rid of those virus factories is the only way we can take care of that. One of the concerns that I have is that one of my friends was at a dinner recently with a couple who the day before, had dinner in a farmhouse in England that was right across the road from where a foot and mouth disease affected farm was located. And they were telling us about how little precautions had been taken either in the airports in England or in the airport in Miami, Florida, when they got to this country to try to ensure that they weren't carrying something in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me add to that. I've had several of my colleagues been over in France or in Europe in the last month over spring break, and I've traveled a lot internationally. I just have not been out of the country in the last few weeks, and they're telling me the same thing, that they're not being as careful, they thought, and as people came into our airports as maybe they should be. I'm concerned that maybe we don't have enough personnel in the airports to handle all the people coming in to follow all the proper procedures. So that's why I made the earlier comment on the air that everyone that's traveling should, you know, personally take some precaution of laundering their clothes and disinfecting their shoes and doing the, and not being in contact with animals once they get back, because I'm not sure our airports are being as strict as maybe they ought to be.
So what you would favor would be for the airports, for example, to, you know, they always have the question about whether you've been at a farm, and if you had people check off yes, then they should have them, remove all their clothes and change into clothes from their suitcases or something like that and throw away the old ones or put them in plastic bags, or what kind of thing would you favor?
To double bag these, and you get, if you could put these in a plastic bag, if you were to go to a farm, say in England, mm-hmm. I would recommend that you take the clothing that you wore when you got back to the hotel or wherever you're staying.
Mm-hmm.
Put those clothes into a plastic bag and probably put that plastic bag inside another one.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're double plastic bagging these.
Right.
And bring those back to this country if it's not convenient to launder or dry clean those while you're in England.
Mm-hmm.
To bring them, if you're bringing them here, then to get them in and get them laundered as soon as you return before you put them on to wear them again.
What about shoes?
Shoes should be washed off with this solution that would be made with 5 tablespoons of chlorine bleach, like you would use just regular household bleach. Put 5 tablespoons of that in a gallon of water and use it to scrub off the soles and any soil that might be on your shoes.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Well, I think we're about at the point where we're going to have to stop, and I have a couple of people I'm sorry that I can't take, but we're just going to have to leave it at that. I do, however, want to thank both of our guests, Marshall Martin, Director of the Center for Agricultural Policy and Technology Assessment at Purdue. Professor Martin, thank you very much. And H. Leon Thacker, he's Professor of Veterinary Pathology. Professor Thacker, thank you.
Thank you.